Welcome back to Feeding the Mouth That Bites You, a weekly podcast guide on parenting teens and launching them into the world. I'm Cynthia Yanoff, and as always, I'm joined by psychologist and author Dr. Ken Wilgus. Dr. Ken, how you doing?
I'm good, Cynthia. How are you?
I'm good. Mike Yanoff, my husband, the other day called and he's like, I have to tell you something. Your podcast is so good. And I was like, oh, mesmerized? He's like, no. And he was like, I was like, sidetracked? He's like, didn't listen. And I was like,
those are Cynthia's other podcasts, everybody.
Yeah, I was like, okay. I was like, we're getting down to all I've got. I was like, feeding the mouth. He goes, yeah. He goes, man, I really enjoyed it. He's like, y'all are so fun. And he goes, but you know what? I like that I walked away and I learned something. Like I felt like a better parent after hearing Dr. Ken. He listened to the one on dysregulation. And so he was like, yeah, he's like, you enjoy, have you been doing that long? I'm like, only been here for about 6 months. But anyway, I just thought that was, he tuned in, he enjoyed, and he was affirming what we all know, that you give such good help and tidbits. Like you do walk away feeling like, okay, I learned something. So good work.
I just hate hearing a husband dig himself into a hole. And because I'm sure he used that tone, like, no, not that one. What?
Mm-hmm. And then
the surprised point, mm-hmm. I actually learned some. Okay. Well mm-hmm. done, sir. You're not doing well here.
It was somewhere between a compliment and I was like, huh, we might need some counseling. So if Mike and I try to get in, I know you probably don't do a lot of marriage counseling, but we may have to start.
Yeah.
So
yeah, doing a lot.
Yeah. So let's talk about our kids and wealth and growing up, whether we're raising them with wealth, without wealth, wishing we had more wealth, wishing they had more opportunity. I think we get all tied up in this with our kids. And it's funny, I remember my kids, my top two went to a private school here in the Dallas area. And when they were fairly young, one of them came home and said, hey, where's our ranch? And I was like,
I know what that school is.
I'm like, our ranch is on Preston Road. That's not actually the road the school's on. But like, I was like, it's on that road and it's this brown building.
Yeah,
and
so, yeah.
But I did have that moment as a parent of being like, oh my gosh, we don't have a ranch and not really, like I wasn't panicking, but that's a dumb example of how we can feel that way, that we don't have enough, or we have people that are on the other extreme that like, am I ruining them? And so you and I were texting and you said, let's talk about affluenza. And I was like, well, let's do. So what does that term even mean? What's it a reference to? And let's go from there.
Well, I hate that term first came out and some listeners are going, oh, I've heard that. The first time I ever heard that term was in a court case about this teenage boy that had like literally killed people and his parents divorced and they were just trying to protect him from any consequence. And anyway, this psychologist that I think was trying to make a good point was, listen, if you're going to testify about some kid's difficulties because it came from poverty and didn't have anything, he just thought, you know, you should know that there is such a thing as the kind of damage done by being raised in an overly entitled, have everything you need kind of environment that he called affluenza. So it's a terrible, I think, argument in court. But I think any psychologist like me listening to that, I know just what he's talking about, that it is hard on children when they are given most everything that they want and really more than they need and treated as if they deserve all of these great things. And then parents turn around going, I can't believe how spoiled he is. Well, I'm like, well, you know, you kind of set this up.
Mm-hmm. So how do we evaluate that line of, I want to provide well for my kids, but I don't want to over provide, and understanding that that's going to look different for different people. I mean, I think, you know, in the poorest of countries, providing well for your children is, an everyday struggle that's going to look different than maybe it does in this country. And so that's a loaded question, but if someone's sitting here and saying like, I don't know, am I giving them too much? Am I giving them enough? How do we evaluate it?
Well, I think it's important to think about, we're not saying that parents who have a lot of money, therefore, are going to be bad parents. The issue is how you treat that the issue of your money. The reason this comes up a lot with feeding the mouth parents is because, I've said this before, parents that are very impoverished, really, they don't have the same struggles with their teenagers rebelling and all of that, because, first of all, they don't have the ability to control their teenager poor parent, or like a rich parent feels they can. And so it tends to come up a lot. And it's not just having the money. So I think a couple things to think about is, number one, kind of what of your own lifestyle, what are you sort of setting up for your children that they need to expect? You know, every generation since World War II had more than their parents had in general. There was this increase. Well, that couldn't continue. And I think certainly by my generation, or certainly, I guess, by my children and grandchildren, they're not exceeding us financially. And that's more common now. And that had to stop at some point. But think about, what are you setting up in your children's life by their expectations, even in your own life? If you are super successful and making tons of money and using that at every chance you can to go up and up and up, you change your social strata, you expect, you know, amazing, you know, houses. I remember kids from the probably same school you're talking about that would go spend the night at another, this is a Christian school, which it's a common problem of, it's also a lot of wealthy people's school. You know, you're talking about a house with two elevators and like a servant that met you at the door, like, whoa. Well, the problem with that is that that's just feeling, you know, blessed and happy and successful. But when you raise children, it's going to be hard for them to not feel the pressure of, I must have something similar to this in my own life. So I think it's important to be careful with that. And then secondly, even if you are living in these certain circumstances, especially by adolescence, when you are now establishing the whole lesson of, wait a minute, you're not a child, you're a young adult, and you're preparing your life, it's really important that you not sort of show disrespect by handing your teenager everything they want. It's not at all improper for you to start talking to your teenager about, you know, I'll go half with you if you get a job and can get a car, or these are the things you need to pay for. And the teenager answer of, what are you talking about? You've got a lot of money. I've had teenagers actually say that. The answer to that is, yeah, it's my money. And it would be great if you make your own money someday, but it's not yours. That sounds mean. And it's certainly not what you say to a six-year-old. My house is your house. What we have is yours. You know, that security is helpful. But by 15 and 16, everything I have is yours, can be very demeaning and really almost disrespectful in saying, you'll always be a child in this family and you'll always need me. And you can kind of train them to do that. And it is harmful. It's a kind of affluenza. It's a sort of disease.
Yeah. Yeah. I think about in my home, Mike and I have always kind of tried to be intentional with our kids, our daughter, especially as a firstborn, but we wanted her to be able to marry whoever God wants her to marry. And we want him to be able to give her things that we haven't already given her. And we want her, if the Lord calls her to marry someone that might be a youth minister or might be whatever it is, a missionary, whatever that is, if it's not of an income level that maybe she'd grown accustomed to, we wanted her to, for that not to be a factor. And so we just kind of thought through that. And if, not that we, not implying at all that we have the means to give her every single thing, but if we set her up for a certain lifestyle, set our kids up for a certain lifestyle, it's a hard drop later. I mean, I have lots of sweet friends that would say, like, man, I grew up with a certain level of wealth in our home, and then I married this guy and he's amazing. I'm so glad I did. But man, I didn't know we didn't spend $500 a month on makeup or whatever. And that's, we had some hard marriage moments. And so I think there's just trying to look at the long view of this too. Any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think that that's an important way to look at it as far as, again, how they're going to set up. You can talk to them about, what do you think about your own life? And, you know, are you going to what's important to you. If you have an older teenager that's still saying, well, I just want to make a lot of money, that's a terrible answer because it doesn't say anything about how you're going to do that. And more importantly, what's really valuable. I think that what's implied a lot in what we're saying, however, is that a lot of parents that have a great deal of money are gone a lot. Like, if unless this was inherited wealth, like from Civil War money in your family, then most of the time, somebody or two of you are working your head off to provide all this. And that in itself is weakening your parent role. You definitely want to start by thinking about, isn't it better if I can provide tons of great stuff, even though I'm gone most all time of the time? Any parenting person will tell you, no, that's not good. It is way better for your child that you're there training them, being with them, participating in their life, and them having less is essential. Parents that do this and make that argument that, well, I'm doing it all for my kids while I'm gone about 22 hours out of every 24, that's really, they're answering their own need and then putting an ideology around it. It's really the same thing as, I want my kids to have what I didn't have. You know, that's a strange way to think about it. You train up your children in the way that they need, what they will need for their life. And if you're looking in the rearview mirror going, well, I want to make sure that nothing like what happened to me, it happens to them, like they're never going to be made fun of for not having the right clothes, you're really raising yourself, you know, back in time. But that's not your child's experience, and it's a very bad way to parent. Those are both ways, to be honest, they're ways of being selfish parents.
Yeah. Well, and I think some of the things that we didn't have growing up, or some of those hard knocks growing up, they have been key motivators for later in life. And sometimes you see the kids that grew up under a lot of wealth, or just grew up just having all the things, like they don't have sometimes some of the motivation for work and later things. And so, you know, I do think there's something to not having everything and wanting it enough to motivate you to go get a job and to work hard and to do some of those things. I remember one time I heard this couple that was going through some really hard stuff financially, and they didn't have a lot. And they said, well, we never want our kids to feel it. So if we have to have a little credit card debt, or we have to go ask our parents to, you know, I don't want my kids to feel it. And I remember thinking, I felt it growing up. I remember times when my dad had lost a job, or I remember watching my mom balance a checkbook a couple times, and like I could see the strain in her eyes. Yeah. And that impacted me. Like, oh wow, okay. The seriousness around finances. And so thoughts on that, maybe someone who's listening that's like, listen, we don't have a lot of wealth. I wish I had that luxury, but we don't. But I'm sure as heck gonna do whatever it takes to make sure my kids don't feel it.
I think that when you're under serious financial strain and you have preschoolers, that's probably the one time I can think of that, or a time that, yeah, they don't need to feel that. It is the right thing to do what you can to give them the stability that they need. But at least by elementary school, some of that needs to change. I had the same experience you did. My mother would sit us down and say, you know, my father's going through a hard time at work. We're not sure if he's going to be able to keep his job, and we really need to be careful. To be honest, I don't remember, as a kid, I don't remember what I did. I didn't go make money. I do know they tried to slip powdered milk into a regular milk bottle, and that was cheap. That didn't work. No. But otherwise, saying that, I think, is part of involving your children in your family. But by, as you can guess, by adolescence, not saying that and keeping that a secret is another of 100 ways to say, remember, sweetheart, you're not any different than a 5-year-old. You can't handle any of this. We don't want you to be upset. Let's say you tell your kid that, you know, your dad lost his job and my job is, we're having to stick with mine. And you've got a 15-year-old that says, well, I'm depressed and that's making it worse. I know many parents that would say, now I feel bad because I've made their depression worse. Depression is not sadness. It's a kind of feeling of flat, we've talked about that in another episode, that is out of step with what real life is. And so telling a young adult about your family struggles financially does not cause, you know, depression or whatever. A teenager that tells you that that's making their depression worse is not educated about their struggle. This is a completely different issue. And I have seen that, a kid that's struggling, rolled into kind of what you had heard from your friend, that I want to make sure that because fill in the blank problem they're having, I don't want them to know this. Well, that's not their age group. A long time ago in this program, when Jessica, the host, had went through cancer, she had multiple myeloma. It was serious business. And she had older teenagers, and one that I think had just barely a teenager. And she picked different ways of talking to them about it, including things, I'm going to need your help. Mm-hmm. And her kids absolutely stepped up. There's a famous point where they went boating or something, and the boat got kind of stuck. And Jessica's husband, great guy, apparently said something like, she needs to get out of the boat and try to help us pull this boat off the shoal or whatever they were stuck on. And the teenage kids were like, Dad, she needs to sit there. She doesn't feel good. You know, they're helping mm-hmm. protect her because they're young adults.
Yeah.
We're not all about shaping the world around them so their fragile little selves can handle it. We're preparing them for, in not very much time, they will be participating in all this themselves.
Yeah, yeah. And so let's talk entitlement for a minute. And I think you would agree with this. You can see entitlement in kids from any income.
That's
bracket,
right. That's right.
Like that's not a money issue. It's what? A value issue. It's a what is that? And what does it look like? What's an early sign of entitlement that you're like, whoa, rein that in?
Yeah, and affluenza then would be kind of extreme entitlement, you know, in a way. And so I think one of the biggest hallmarks is that they're a lack of gratitude. These are kids that, you know, I call entitlement is those who have come to expect that which they do not deserve. And so when you have kids that are not asking, could you take me to do this thing? But they're telling you, I'm going to be late. You have to take me. That's again, a sense of out of place expectations. More than just proper social etiquette. I don't mind if you have your little kids. They need to say thank you, learn to. But a teenager that is like, oh, sorry, thank you. That teenager, you need to sit down and go, so why is this so hard for you? Do you really think that me taking you to these things, I have to drive 45 minutes each way? I've been watching the Olympics, you know. And do you just think that's my job? Because that's what it feels like. And I think you and I have a difference of view here, because you seem to continually forget that this is not owed to you. And again, it's not helpful to shame teenagers for it, but the goal of pointing it out and then maybe looking at ways to reshuffle the responsibility chart here to, again, I always say this, to ramp up the respect. When you are overly entitling, overly coddling a teenager, you are loving them in a sort of nurturing way, but you're not respecting them. And yeah. They can feel that. And they grow up, you know, an affluenza kid is one that is always a child. Always. And that's what I think in this court case, which again, that's not my point, but that's what was being argued, is that this kid's never going to grow up. He's always going to feel like, and of course, but in that case, that kid knew better. You know, this was murder. This is not, or this is, you know, a reckless homicide kind of thing. That wasn't going to fly. But as for, is this kid really hamstrung? Is a young adult who was raised in a wealthy setting and had everything they wanted, aren't they doing great? Oh, no. All of us psychologists went, no, they're not doing well at all. They don't see their own effectiveness, and they have expectations that just put huge pressure on them later in life for their own success and what they should be able to do without help from their parents. They kind of feel like they could never make it.
Yeah. Okay, as we're wrapping up, this is going to be one of those, like, that's going to age me a million years. But I kind of feel like, remember when our parents were like, I used to walk 2 miles to school, uphill, both, that whole thing.
Both ways.
In the snow. And, you know, on your, like, no, you were literally in El Paso, Texas. There's not been snow there in a decade, but okay. This is one, this is maybe my moment. My husband and I laugh about this, but we've seen this a little bit in our kids' friends, our older kids and their friends, but also in even my husband's workplace hiring younger employees. There's not the work ethic by and large that maybe
I hear
we
this
saw.
A lot.
I yes. was telling one of my daughter that's headed to law school. I was like, when I got out of law school, this is my uphill both ways. But I'm like, I work 50, 60 hour weeks without question. And that was the expectation. And I was happy to have a job. And now, you know, and since COVID, and I'm glad they're doing this. There's a couple of days you can work at home at a lot of places. But I hear my kids' friends like, this is horrible. Stay in school. I mean, they want you there like every day. And I'm like, imagine. They want you at the job where they're
paying. And no summer break.
I know that they hate us here. Right. But I'm just wondering about this a little bit. Some of it's generational. I get that. And I'm not trying to criticize it all. I'm saying some of it in jest, but also at the same time, thoughts on like teaching our kids, like, do our kids need to work in high school? Does that need to be like, I don't care what income bracket you're in. They need to be working in high school. They need to work in college. I mean, I don't know. I'm just wondering, there's probably not a hard and fast rule, but in light of the fact that I'm not the only one that's seeing this, we see tons of coverage of this in the news and other places that this next generation maybe doesn't love to work by and large. So what can we do on that? And how can we get in front of it a little?
Well, you're right. There's not a hard and fast rule, but there's lots of data on the advantage of working an appropriate amount. So in high school, an athletic or otherwise informing, life-informing event, like you're involved in music, athletics, those things can, in to some degree, substitute for your work. But definitely you want to link those two, that you should be working to support part of your own your own life now that you are 16, for example. But I think saying, here's the deal, though, because we know that, you know, that your sport takes you out the whole summer and all this stuff. We're going to waive that. I think that's a good way to put it, because then certainly if a kid drops stuff, or like, I don't want to anymore, it adds to that what should go without saying. There's no such thing as you dropping your sport or your activity so you can hang out at home and entertain yourself a bunch. I think working, the expectation that you should work when you can, starting in certainly by 16, is not bad at all. So a lot of evidence in college, especially kids with learning differences, focus problems, working 10 to 15 hours a week actually helps a lot in structuring. They don't do well with wide open, I've got 4 days to get ready for this paper, and then they, you know, hustling at 10 p.m. the night before. So a job that is not overly burdensome is actually quite helpful, not only for, you know, the fact that they're, you know, making income, but it's also good for their own sense of time schedule and so forth. I know with my kids, we really expected them to work. We probably could have figured it out if they didn't, but I know my son set the standard in that he announced, okay, I'm not going to need anything from you as far as free money or expectation. And he was at one point team leader of the snow crew. He went to school up north, and he would get up at 5 and had to wake up other college kids at 5 to go shovel the walks and so forth. And I think he felt, you know, great pride in that, as he should have. And we certainly made a big deal out of, you know, man, I don't know how you do that. And he loved that, because it was, it's part of being effective. And if we had announced, you know what, you've been such a good boy this next year, we're just going to cover all that. Mm-hmm. I think that would have been a terrible response.
Well, and don't we all want that sense of satisfaction of being needed and being useful? And, you know, that sounds like, and I'm glad you clarified he was up north, because I was getting ready to say, no, there's no way
he went to school in El Paso and
dead in El Paso with all their snow. He was
he's making that up.
Well, and I will say this too, with having kids who played a lot of sports, and really literally like one of mine, football. I mean, it almost becomes year round. It feels like trying to get him really a summer job. I mean, we would have him apply and he'd be like, I can work from 10 to 2 on Tuesday, Thursdays, and then every other week. And I'm like, who would hire this kid? I wouldn't.
It's true.
You know, we put in place an expectation of, we had a weird situation because we had a small child, I still do, but you know, they had a very young sibling and we're like, we don't pay babysitters. You're the babysitter. And this is your job. Like when we want to go and
that's
if you
good.
Have on Friday night,
that's good.
We have plans on Friday night too. And this is how you work to help our family. And so we put other things in place that were within the house. There's expectations around working at times when they couldn't work outside of the house. So I don't know if that's helpful to anybody, that might be something you can do.
I think it is. It's important.
So, all right. Well, I'd love to chat more, but I've got to go spend some money and be affluent. And I don't know, whatever the affluence is, I got to go brush up on that.
You're heading out, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. You. Right.
We're praying for your husband.
Right. I'm praying. Yeah, surely. We just did, everyone, if you haven't listened, we just did one on apologizing. So to the extent we offended anyone, once again, I want to apologize for that, Dr. Ken.
Up front, doing repair.
Yeah, doing the repair. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Skincare experts and dermatologists have often touted the benefits of indoor humidity as essential for healthy, glowing skin. But did you know dry air can start to harm your skin in as little as 30 minutes? For years, many people have relied on humidifiers for better skin, sleep, and overall wellness. But traditional models? Bulky, mold-prone, and difficult to maintain. That's where Canopy Humidifier comes in. Recommended by leading dermatologists, Canopy is a completely reimagined humidifier designed to elevate any space, offering the ultimate in skincare and wellness benefits. Canopy's clean moisture combats dryness, dullness, and fine lines while strengthening the skin's barrier and boosting the effectiveness of topical skincare products. With its sleek design, Canopy is the cleanest and easiest humidifier on the market. With its unique technology, cleaning is as easy as popping it in the dishwasher. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy humidifier purchase today with Canopy's filter subscription. Even better, use code PODCAST at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Your skin will thank you.